With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, Podalters. In this week's episode, I speak to Michaela Loach. Michaela is a climate justice and anti-racism activist. She's a writer and she's also in her fourth year at medical school. We discuss the UK civil rights movement, white supremacy and climate justice, which are the three things that Michaela wishes she had been taught in school. This is one of my favourite adulting episodes ever, so I really hope you enjoy it. Michaela was such a wonderful guest and, as she says, a really lovely human being. So cute. As always, please do rate, review, and subscribe. Bye. Hello, and welcome to Adulting. Today, I'm joined by Michaela Loach.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm like spending my study slash work from home time sitting in front of my sad lamp for like 10 hours a day, which actually I think has made me trick myself into thinking it's summer, even though it's freezing. And it's been quite good for my brain.
This is what everyone has been telling me to get, and like, for years, because I definitely get really impacted by the dark and I just haven't bitten the bullet to get one. And maybe this is a sign that I really need to do that.
No, it's a really good investment. Like I get like quite low in the winters usually, so it's genuinely like changed my life. Would really recommend.
Okay, yeah, I keep getting reminded. I need to do it because I definitely, when it's sunny, I can like jump out of bed. I'm so excited for the day ahead. And if it's dark, I'm like, no, I don't want to do anything. So stressful. Okay, so before we get into the chat, could you give us an introduction to Michaela, who you are, what you're doing? You mentioned you're studying. So just a little bit about you.
Yeah, sure. I'm Michaela Loach. I am a fourth year medical student based in Edinburgh, which is why it's so cold up here. So I'm currently on clinical placement, which during a pandemic is like a whole thing. But I'm also a climate justice activist and a co-host of a podcast called The Yikes Podcast, where we talk about climate justice and anti-oppression and trying to make these conversations as like accessible and inclusive as possible. Because we feel like sometimes there can be barriers in the way of people getting involved with these things by just not kind of understanding the lingo. I'm also a writer. Like I write lots of different things and I write on my Instagram as well and communicate things through my Instagram page. And I think I've covered the things, I think. I'm always like, have I missed something? I usually miss out medical student, because I think it's ended up being like my side thing, which is so weird. But I think I've got it.
Oh, that's it. You're definitely a multi-hyphenate person. You've got so many things going on. Have you always been like this? Like when you were younger and when you were at school, have you always been someone that's very proactive and creating?
Yeah, I think so. I think that like I've always kind of, it's this weird thing of like thriving on being busy, but I'm trying to challenge myself on that a lot more recently to realize that being busy all the time isn't always a good thing, and especially if you're not looking after yourself and like caring for yourself. But I think definitely like my whole life I've always been working on whatever other projects or like caring about a lot of different like social justice issues whilst also kind of having this academic path at the same time. So I've just always kind of been busy. I used to actually, now this is such a random thing, but yeah, I used to always do loads of like drama stuff at school. I completely forgot about that until now. But I'd always be like doing all these random kind of small projects at the same time. And then I'd always have to check myself at some point and be like, you're doing too much, take a break. But I think recently, especially in the last year, I've had to like really focus a lot more on resting as well as being busy and doing all this stuff. And also realizing how much my maybe need to be busy or prioritizing busyness so much is like a manifestation of like internalized capitalism, and therefore I need to kind of resist that as well and not just try and be busy all the time.
Oh, it's so fascinating. But the thing is, it's so glamorized to be so busy. So actually I'm by nature someone that isn't, I'm not necessarily kind of like predisposed to be very like hustle culture and like worked. I'm quite good at resting naturally, but I find myself feeling really like judging myself if I'm not sort of like
at the minute, obviously with the pandemic, I think psychologically it can be really difficult to be on top of everything. And I keep getting, I'm like, no, it's fine. We're in a pandemic. Like, you don't have to create the next big thing or whatever it is. And then I get all this guilt, definitely, as you said, like fed by capitalism, for this idea that we have to constantly be striving to keep achieving and never really sitting back into contentment. And it's funny that it's such an irrational like feeling of guilt or fear, because it doesn't help anyone if you're burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is something that I've been reading a lot about in the last year, like the idea of like radical self-care and self-care as resistance that Audre Lorde and Angela Davis talk about a lot. And I read this really great article by Vice that talked about Black power naps and like the sleep gap that exists between the Black community and the white community, and how that that sleep gap and the almost rest gap as well, the gap between how much like rest is allowed to the white community and to the Black community, that is a legacy of white supremacy and a manifestation of it in today, that like through sleeping and getting good sleep, your body and your brain is given that kind of ability to dream and imagine, and you use parts of your brain in sleep that kind of allow yourself to manifest creativity, and how much creativity and this ability to imagine is so inherently linked to being able to see a future and being able to envision a better future, and how that's been taken away from the Black community, and therefore to choose to rest and to choose to like to sleep and to get adequate sleep and look after yourself is a way that you can, that the Black community especially, can allow ourselves to envision a proper future and also like be healthy by the time that we can get to that future. And I just thought that was really beautiful and moving.
Wow. So is that because sort of systemically, I was about to say historically, but also currently, obviously people, Black working people low paid wage jobs or don't have the luxury or access to rest. Is that where that stemmed from?
So yeah, I think there's a lot of different things. So in the time of like transatlantic and chattel slavery, like kind of deprivation of sleep and having to constantly be working was something that was obviously quite key to that whole system. And that has continued, yes, through like lower paid jobs, but also I think part of it will be manifesting in the whole like idea that you have to work twice as hard, and that Black people do generally have to work twice as hard to get the same amount. And therefore there's this idea of like not being able to rest, because we talk so much in the Black community, especially about like celebrating Black excellence all the time. And sometimes I'm like, it's also okay to just be like normal and not be excellent and just kind of exist as a person. And I think there is this kind of expectation of like having to work super hard in order to, I don't know, to like justify our existence. And that will manifest in how much good sleep you get, as well as like the amount of sleep. Yeah, it's super interesting. I think there's so many different reasons, but this is something that I've been like thinking about and like reading about a lot.
No, that makes so much sense in terms of like, we so often recognize how often people of color and Black people aren't given the room to be human. You're either superhuman or you're demonized. And so exactly what you're talking about, that chasm in the middle, just to be, isn't facilitated in the world we live in, which is fucked up. As I'm sure we know. Have you read Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep?
No, I haven't. I've heard it recommended to me so many times, but I really, until probably like a few months ago, I was really struggling with my sleep, and I thought that reading it would stress me out more because it would show me how much me not sleeping was harming my health. And I was like, I can't read this right now. But I think I'm at the point now where everyone, I've heard so many people say it's amazing. My mum like said it was really, really great. And so I do need to read it because everyone says it's so good.
It is really good. I think it does make you want to sleep because you're like, shit, I need to get in those hours. Like I was thinking about when I was at uni and I used to do like all nighters, and it's like even one all nighter can, and I'm like, no, I did many. No,
that's so scary. I definitely can pull an all nighter sometimes. That's quite.
Yeah, I imagine with all your work on as well, you're probably up. I remember when my sister was doing her medical degree, she just never would be asleep. And we were like, Emily, you need to rest.
Oh gosh.
So much work. Also, there is actually a Joe Rogan episode with Matthew Walker. I don't normally listen to Joe Rogan, but it's a really good entry into the book if you can't be bothered to read it straight away. And it kind of covers a lot of the points. It's a really good chat. As like an entry. Okay, so as I'm sure you know, this season we're talking about the three things that you wish you'd been taught in school. And the first thing that you've chosen is that you wish you'd been taught about the civil rights movement in the UK, which I think is so important. I mean, I still don't feel even that clued up on it. And we hear so much about the civil rights movement in the US, but in the UK, it's just not really what's definitely not part of our curriculum. And I don't think it's even part of like common knowledge. So when did you start to know about that? Was it something that you were taught about post-school, when you're at school? Was it family, friends, research? What was it that enlightened you to learning about this?
So I think this is something that I'm still learning so much about, and that I only started really learning about the civil rights movement from a UK perspective, probably when I read Akala's book, Natives, when he started touching on kind of some of that stuff. And that was, I know, quite a few years ago. But that was kind of my first opening into that. But before then, because I grew up in Surrey, so that's like just outside of London, if people don't know where it is, but in like very, very white Surrey. And we were like the only black family, like at least in my area. And at school, the only times that I was taught about black history was being taught about chattel slavery, but through the lens of, but Britain abolished slavery. And we only ever got taught about the civil rights movement in the US. And everything that we were taught was basically like, oh my gosh, yay, liberation has been fought and won by people in the past. There's nothing left to do. Britain did nothing apart from abolish slavery. Woo, that's the end of it. And it meant that I think even like as a young person, part of me was like, oh, it's because if you're just being taught that, then you're going to kind of believe it's true. But then my parents, like thankfully, taught me a lot of other things. But because I'm Jamaican, so I was born in Jamaica, I got taught a lot more about like Jamaican history and then also how Jamaican history connected more to like US history. So there was this big gap in my knowledge that I only realized as an adult about the civil rights movement in the UK. And I didn't even realize that there were British Black Panthers and stuff, which seems like so silly to me now, but I didn't know about the Mangrove Nine. I didn't know about the Bristol bus boycotts. I didn't know about so many different things that happened. And it's only been like, yeah, as an adult, reading books like Natives by Akala, reading Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Reni Eddo-Lodge, where the first chapter is just about black history, listening to the History Hotline podcast, which is a podcast all about black history in the UK, which has episodes on the Mangrove Nine, who were nine individuals who faced prison pretty much as like a consequence of them being harassed by the police and then protesting against that. From reading books and from the Small Acts series. So I'm like rambling so many different resources, but because I'm really excited by all these things that are coming out now that hopefully will mean that kids who are like I was when I was younger will now be kind of surrounded by this information that has been deliberately restricted from us for so long for a reason. Because if people think that racism historically has been more of a problem in the US than in the UK, and that liberation was only fought in the US and not in the UK, then they'll think that like this kind of exceptionalism that's taught about this British exceptionalism is true, when really it's just not.
I totally agree. I remember when I first read Rennie's blog before her book came out, and it was like, I don't think she mentioned the history in that, but she was mentioning about even just the ideas of like systemic and institutionalized racism within the UK. And I definitely had accepted this idea that, you know, oh, it's really bad in the US, but it's not really the same over here. And obviously with my privilege blinding me to not be able to, I wasn't experiencing racism, so I didn't know that it was happening all the time. It was such a smack in the face to read her book and be like, oh my God, I remember reading it and like being with friends or being with Matt. And I'd be like, did you know this? Every page and neither of us had any idea. And it is so important, as you say, all of these books have come out, but it's shocking to think. I mean, I know I've actually just ordered Audre Lorde and Angela Davis because I haven't read either of them yet, but I just ordered some of their books the other day and I'm really excited to read them. And obviously there have been texts around, but obviously they weren't accessible in the way that they are now, and people didn't speak about them in the way that they did then, or those who were speaking about it didn't have the platform to shout about them. So it seems incredible that there's been such a big time lapse between these things happening and us accessing the information about them, as you say, very deliberately.
Yeah, it's just like, I think with all of these things, I think we need to always remember that all of these things are a choice. Like what's been chosen to be put in the curriculum for schools is a choice. The fact that at the school that I went to for my GCSEs, I think it was, the civil rights movement in the US was a course that schools could choose to teach their students. But there's not a course on Black British history or the civil rights movement in the UK that students can learn about. So all of these choices are made for a reason, so that because when we don't know about our history, we're like so much more disempowered to be able to create change because we can't really learn about what's happened before. And I think that I've even found like watching the Small Axe series that came out on BBC, which is a series of films about like British Caribbean stories, and they were directed by Steve McQueen. And I, even watching some of those, I was like weirdly shocked at what I was watching and how these were stories that happened and that there's so much documentation about, and that I shouldn't have been shocked because obviously we've been like restricted from so many things, but I was shocked to see how kind of omnipresent the police brutality, and so how violent and how kind of open it wasn't even disguised in any way. At least now it's disguised in some way for a lot of communities, but just watching these films that were based in not history that's not even that far in the past, like history that's within my parents' lifetime, probably within my definitely within my grandparents' lifetime. I think there's a reason why we're not taught about this, and it is really concerning. And then I think that a lot of other people in the Black community will have learned about this stuff because there are things like Pan-African SASDAE schools and SASDAE schools that are made by people within the community to try and teach their own kids about their actual history. Because there's a quote by Marcus Garvey that says, "A people without knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots." I think that's something that we need to think about a lot, is if we don't know about our own history, and Black history isn't just for Black people, it's also so intertwined with everyone else's history because we all make up part of society. And if we don't know about the holistic picture of history, then we kind of, it's going to be so much easier for us to perpetuate the worst parts of it and perpetuate so much more harm. And that's why I just think it's so important that we do learn about all these things. And Black history is British history. And I just think that it's so sad how we've been kind of have that stripped away from us. Sorry, I'm rambling a lot now.
No, you're not rambling. I was just trying to think about when I was doing English literature at uni, like how many of the books we had from Black authors. And there were a few, but there were also separate modules that were dedicated to Black writers. And when you think about that, like as you just said, that's actually really weird that it wouldn't just be integrated, because, and probably more importantly, it is white people and white students and white children that need to learn about the racist history of Britain and the civil rights movement. Because as you say, like as a Black person, you're experiencing racism every day, and that history might have been taught to you by community members, or because you might start to question like where it's come from. Whereas the problem is, like, I was so blinded, I really didn't understand. And I was much too old. I was in like my early 20s when I started really to understand this. And that's much too late, I think, in someone's life to like not understand something that's so seismic.
Yeah, and I think that it's just like, it shouldn't be that we should have to seek this stuff out ourselves. Like most of the stuff that I've kind of learned from it are things that are community projects or just individuals who've decided to do stuff themselves. Like the History Hotline podcast is just run by someone who did their master's in specifically in Black British history and realized that there's just this huge kind of gap in people not understanding Black British history, and she wanted to make it accessible to people because it's already not that accessible. Like in one podcast episode, she talks about how for Black History Month in the UK, even Black politicians in the UK, the examples of people that they'd used of freedom fighters and of activists in the past would be Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Angela Davis, maybe. So they'd only use examples of civil rights leaders in the US to talk about liberation. And that shows how much we've kind of Americanized this whole idea of civil rights, when actually there are people like Barbara Beese and Althea Jones the Coin and so many other people in the UK who were also fighting for liberation. There were Black Panthers in the UK. There were so many other different organizations. There's a rich history of resistance, especially in the Black community in this country. And too often, like, we can only ever think of these names. And this is also something that I would only have been able to name civil rights activists in the US. And yeah, I just think it's something that we just need to be learning more about. And it's great that there are the small acts films that are available on BBC iPlayer, and that the Black curriculum on Instagram and on other platforms do some really amazing education, and the History Hotline and Sitting in Limbo, which is a documentary, well, not documentary, it's a, like a drama about the Windrush scandal. It's great that these things exist, but they're still so niche. And it's like, why should Black history be this like niche add-on when actually it's central to all of our lives? And this, in this country, the UK's wealth was built off the pillaging and harm of Black people all over the world. And yet they want to ignore like kind of what that history has meant or what that history was, and just tell us all to move on and everything, when actually that history is also happening now, and that history is also present now.
And as you said before, it's a very like recent history. I actually didn't do history for GCSE because I thought it was so boring. I can't remember what we'd done in year nine, but maybe it was like Tudors, and we'd done like 1066 in like the Battle of Hastings in year seven. I was like, this is like not interesting. Whereas I think I would have been really emotionally engaged in a conversation about the UK civil rights movement, because it would have felt so important to me in a way that like would be relevant to our lives today. And it just seems like, it's such an obvious omission, isn't it, really? Because the stuff we learned about was just not useful. Like, it was so far back in history that actually it doesn't necessarily have the same impact as learning about things that are really, really recent and unequivocally impact our day-to-day lives every single day and the way that we operate. And I guess this kind of actually leads us quite well onto your second thing that you wish you'd been taught in school, which
is actually one thing, what you just said, I'd like to just say, because I think that you've made a really good point there about like the fact that the things you were taught didn't impact you. And I think that that's the point, is that they don't want to teach us things that are going to cause us to realize the inequality that exists in the world today. Like, they can teach us about the Tudors and Henry's six wives, because that's not going to cause people to realize, oh, wait a minute, this is unequal in our society. Or wait, like, it's not going to have the same impact of exposing the inequality and the violence that exists in our world. And that's why I think it's like a deliberate choice. And I just wanted to like just comment on what you said there, because I think that is really key. It's like, they don't want to teach us more recent history because they don't want us to really question the status quo that exists now.
It's so insidious when it's actually just so simple, isn't it? Like, sometimes I have episodes, I'm like, oh, that's weird. And it's not weird. It's all very deliberate. And even if it's not deliberate on the part of the teachers, it's like everything trickles into one another. And it's quite sickening when you sort of look at it for what it is. Sorry. So yeah, so your second thing, you said you'd wish you'd been taught about what white supremacy is and how to dismantle it. And I think, yes, I mean, definitely. When was your first knowledge of the word white supremacy or the concept?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. I'm not actually sure. That's a really good question. I actually don't know when I was, because I think there was definitely a point in my life where I think I was given the words to express things that I already knew existed. And I think that was a really powerful moment. I think that's why language can be really powerful, because it can really equip us. Like, I actually remember, I think the first time that I had read about microaggressions was in Slay in Your Lane. And I think you did a podcast episode with the authors that I listened to at the time. Yes. Yeah. And that book actually I found was really formative for me in like communicating a lot of things that I've been experiencing, or at least me being able to rationalize a lot of the things that I've been experiencing and realize what they were, and realize that I wasn't like losing my mind. Like, this was racism, because the kind of world that I grew up in, I was in very, very white environments and very not very like civil resistance-y environments. And therefore I didn't have the people around me to kind of equip me with these different words or language or concepts. So I think from a very, very young age, from probably as long as I can remember, I knew that white supremacy existed, but I don't know if I don't know when I had the words for that, or when I was given the words. It was probably very early on in my life, but because of the places I grew up in, I was othered from quite a young age, and I was like made to feel like I didn't fit in, because I didn't fit in where I grew up. But then I was also experiencing like racist violence and all these different things. I think that like, whilst I was aware that this was a thing, I didn't have the words to like just to know how to dismantle it, or what dismantling would mean, or how it operates. I think my kind of understanding of white supremacy, at least as a child and as a young person, was always more in like kind of anecdotally, like things that I would experience or reading about the civil rights movement in the, always seemed to be from a US context. But I didn't have the same kind of like arsenal that I think I have now, thanks to people who I've read, like Renée Adeloye, and thanks to, in my like adult years, reading Angela Davis and Audre Lorde, and reading Leah Sard's work, and Rachel Cargo, and all these amazing people who I think for me have just kind of explained all these things. And when you understand something, you it's so much easier to tackle it.
I agree. I think that it's interesting, because I was asking that because it's only in the last few years that I've learned to see white supremacy for what it is, which is everywhere, systemic, insidious. Whereas I think when I was younger, and I can't remember what age, but probably like early, late teens, I would have thought white supremacy was purely like the Ku Klux Klan or some other group which committed overt violent racism on other people, and that was like who they were. I think that, again, through work like Leila Saad and Renée Adeloye, my understanding of it has become the words. I think that everyone used to give that like white supremacy as a concept so much power, as if it was almost like saying Voldemort, like you can't, the word is more powerful than the thing, and never actually address the fact that white supremacy is inherently present everywhere. Do you know what I mean? I feel like that's almost how it permeated my consciousness, as like a tangible thing that you can go, that's white supremacy, whereas what it is invisible and everywhere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I think like obviously existing, I think also, so because of the spaces I existed in, like my like blackness was much more visible because of those spaces. So I think I'd always been aware that it was intertwined into everything. But I think my understanding of white supremacy as being something that was created deliberately and that is upheld actively has changed a lot. And so therefore my understanding of, and so by that I mean that white supremacy isn't like an inherent thing that has existed in the world since the start of time. It's something that was created in order to subjugate and marginalize and commit violence against groups who did not fit into this white category. Like race is a social construct, and it being a social construct doesn't mean that we dismiss its existence. It just means that we acknowledge that kind of these systems like white supremacy that have been created to harm people are creations. They're not inherent things.
Yeah.
And that kind of can take us away from this eugenics weird argument. Like, I think it's only been and I think that my understanding of things changes all the time. And I think that's really important and wonderful for all of us, that we can be wrong about things and change and develop our ideas. And I think in recent years, my understanding, and especially in the last like couple of years, my understanding of white supremacy has impacted my life and my actions in so many ways, because I've realized that if it's a system that was created by people, and if it's a system that is upheld by people, then if we are allowing ourselves to be comfortable within this system, then we are upholding this system, we're upholding white supremacy. And that as much as I think it's talked about like all the time, people seem to talk about all the time, like, oh, well, we need people to like what we're doing in order for change to happen, or we don't want to cause too much disruption, like blah, blah, blah. But if we're never going to disrupt the system as it is currently, then we're just upholding it. Like if the actions that we're doing don't cause a real tangible shift, then are we just like kind of upholding this same system, but in a different way? And that's really challenged me, I think, on my activism a lot, because I've been like, how much of this is me just creating, maybe pushing towards the same world as it is now, but that just might be labeled differently or look a bit different. Like, shouldn't we want to overturn all of this and completely create like a complete new world? And that requires destruction. And I don't think destruction is always a bad thing, because if we're destructing something if we're destructing white supremacy, which is harmful and awful, then that is a good thing. And that's why I think I use the word dismantle white supremacy, and I'm still like checking myself a lot on the word dismantle, because I'm like, if we dismantle it, does that mean it's still possible for someone else to put it back together? I know this is such like a strange thing to think about, but I think a lot about language, and I'm like, or do we just want to destroy it so it's not possible for it to kind of come back? Do we like destruction and like, yeah, and things being agitated doesn't always have to be a bad thing, and in us doing this work and real work that really like will destroy white supremacy and create a whole new world will require people to be uncomfortable and like us to be uncomfortable in different ways. I think about how, I think I saw today that in the height of Martin Luther King's activism, who he's seen, I guess, now because they've like whitewashed him and made him more palatable throughout history. But he's seen now as like the more palatable activist. And yet in the height of his activism, 68% of people didn't agree, like white people didn't like what he had to say and didn't think he was a good person. And so that's the majority of people thought he, let alone like imagine what people thought about Malcolm X, imagine what they thought about other people. So it's like, we aren't going to get our freedom through appeasing people and through everyone being comfortable.
This is, I think you've said that, so you're such a beautiful orator. I love listening to you talk. I think that's such an important thing about activism that we often, I think the word's kind of been diluted too much, because I can't talk about it in the sense of, well, I mean, I could, but I directly benefit from white supremacy. So what I'm trying to, let me explain this in a way that, so, okay, when it comes to like feminism, when I first learned about feminism, felt quite radically about how I was going to change my life in order to, and obviously dismantling or destroying white supremacy should fall under feminism as part of intersectionality. But in terms of when it comes to like sexism, sometimes I catch myself and I'm thinking, and I've spoken about this before when it comes to choice feminism, how do I word this? Sometimes you do, because sticking with the status quo, even if the structures of it directly undervalue you or systemically marginalize you or whatever, sometimes you'll realize that if you do the thing in the way that you're supposed to do it, there's can be an individual gain, which is in direct opposition to the universal gain, which would, you know, help everyone else who's either in your the same privileges or whatever as you, or different. And I wonder if with ever, like, that's something, I don't know if I've even worded that in a way that makes sense, but with activism, it's hard sometimes because you'll be maybe really happy and you'll get something that's really good, and then suddenly you have that like, oh my god, mind fuck of realizing that makes you complicit. And I just think that's what's, you're right, I agree, like with activism and with anything, whether that's like in order to change this capitalist racist patriarchy that we live under, the world would literally have to look completely different from how it does now in order for there to have actually been actual change. And that's so scary to think about. So it's really hard striking that balance, I guess. And what I'm trying to ask is, how do you like survive and thrive and dismantle and not, do you know what I mean? Is there, how do we navigate that? Or how do you personally kind of like marry those things together?
Yeah, I think I just, with trying to kind of, I guess, do the best work I can do, that side of it, it's just constantly challenging myself on how and why I do what I do and how I choose to resist or my activism. I think this is something that I'd really recommend that all of us do who are trying to create social change in any way, like constantly check on the ways in which we're doing it and ask yourself, like, why this way? Do you think this way is like really disrupting things? Do you think it's possible that it could be upholding these issues in some way? What do you see as success? How much is that kind of view of success tainted or a reflection of the world as it is currently? Like, I went through a bit of a phase, and I still do sometimes, of being like, because I'm very aware that my work, the kind of work and activism I do, I'll probably never have like a big win ever. Like, I'm not going to have a time where I've probably like had a campaign and there's a clear defined finish or there's a clear defined success from it, because the work that I'm doing is trying to push the world, I think, in like into a bit of a different direction, and that isn't going to have the same kind of deadlines or goals as our world does at the moment, because our, like, obviously, like, capitalist world is very like goal driven and there's a clear defined end or that kind of thing. But I've realized, and I think I've sometimes been like, maybe I should just like have more well-defined goals, and I realized that you can actually step away from that, and stepping away from that is also a way of trying to exist outside of this space. But also it's recognizing within myself, like, where am I putting value on? What am I putting value on? And is that a reflection of the world that I want to create? I think that in making myself healthy as I do all this work and like happy in myself as well as much as I can and feel joy as often as possible. I think it's also having, I think a key part of that is something I mentioned a bit before about sleep and dreams and rest, but it's being able to imagine like, what would I be doing if this new world that I'm striving for was here? Like, what would I be doing in that time? And giving my space, myself space in the world as it is now to try and do some of those things as well. Because I want to get to this new world, and that might not happen within my lifetime, but I want to get to this new world as like a healthy human. And I want all of us to get there as healthy humans. And if I'm like super burnt out and just stressed all the time and sad and heartbroken all of the time, then I'm not going to be the healthiest person I can be at the end of it. And I also just think there's so much importance that needs to be put on joy as well as like something to be felt by all people, and especially those who have been historically oppressed and who are like currently marginalized. I think we just deserve to feel joy and deserve to like really spend some time imagining like, what would we do in this new world? Like, what would we want in this new world? Like, I know for me, one thing, if I was in this new world, if all the problems were solved, I'd just spend all day scuba diving, and that's all I'd do because it's my favorite thing in the whole world. And reading and like sleeping. And so obviously I can't scuba dive right now because it's very cold, but like what I do now is I just take time to rest. I take time to read silly fantasy and fiction books, as well as doing the kind of resistance work and the like important work, because I think all of those things are necessary. And that is also, and part of, I think, seeing that dismantling white supremacy destroying white supremacy also looks like valuing myself enough to care for myself in a way that sits outside of these ideals of like capitalist self-care. Instead, it's like, how can I care for myself in a way that is truly like filling myself up rather than kind of in a more surface way of like this like kind of falsehood of making myself feel better by, I don't know, buying something that's going to give me a temporary kind of joy, hit of joy or something, but instead, like, how do I sustain myself in a joyful way?
I think that's such a brilliant answer. I also would love to be scuba diving and reading. I'd quite happily join like a commune where we just read and scuba dive. That sounds amazing. I'd definitely do that somewhere hot.
Please.
Whilst we're still on this, sorry to take it back to serious, but I just want to ask you, whilst we're on this, still on your second thing of white supremacy, I wondered, whilst you're studying for a medical degree, obviously, to become a doctor, how much is that permeating in your studies? Like, how, I know that during the Black Lives Matter protest, my sister who's a doctor would have colleagues who finally felt like they could speak up and talk about, because obviously it's systemic and it runs through everything. Do you feel like even when you're studying, let alone in school, but perhaps on your course or like even within the hospitals, that there needs to be a massive kind of, I guess, legislative change on the way that we do studies and trials and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think, In my experience, medicine is a white supremacy. It's a cis normative, like heteronormative, horrific patriarchal white supremacy. And it, like, I'm like kind of like laughing there as if this isn't funny. But I think it's more because to exist in this space, in, so I think the rest of the world as a whole is also a white supremacy. It's also like a heteronormative, cisnormative, patriarchal white supremacy. That's the rest of the world, ableist as well, the rest of the world. But medicine is like a lot of those things almost like amplified, because medicine itself is built upon a lot of kind of academia, and academia itself is also very, very built on white supremacy and gatekeeping and keeping people who are kind of undesirable out of that space. But also having a lot of the norms of academia be based upon like white people or white experiences. So when we look at medicine, a lot of the studies that have been done have only been done on white people. And then those kind of statistics or ideals or whatever are kind of put upon the rest of the population. So for example, with BMI studies, the original BMI studies were only done on like white people, and that has been put upon other populations, which means that a lot of Black individuals experience, also I think BMI is complete BS as well, as my understanding, but people have been put onto other populations, and that's a way in which people, especially the Black community, can feel medical racism because they have these ideals of BMI being put up on them. But like also interpersonally with doctors, I've experienced loads of situations of like gaslighting, of microaggressions, of like full-blown like racism, and these are people who have a care over patients, and that's really scary because when someone's got kind of in charge of someone else's life, that is something that is really delicate. And that's why I think I feel quite honored to be in this profession, in the way that at some point I'm going to be like with someone in the most vulnerable part of their life and be a part of hopefully helping that person. And it does scare me how much how many doctors I've met, and I don't think this isn't a bad apples problem. This is like a systemic problem. But how much as well medicine as an institution kind of uphold these ideals of white supremacy and oppression. And I think I actually don't know how to change this. Like I find it really difficult to even kind of conceptualize, because I think the problem is so deep rooted that it would take a very, very, very long time for these kind of issues to be fixed, because already in society as a whole, so many people are stuck on racism doesn't exist, and so can't even move on to like anything else. And so that's what I think is difficult within medicine, is that especially within my experience of medicine, is there are so many people that they're not even at the baseline. They're way below the baseline of understanding about white supremacy or any of this stuff. So then trying to get them to understand how they are perpetuating it is so difficult. Like I've had conversations before with colleagues where I've ended up literally having to give like a 1 hour, well, I don't do it anymore, but I used to, when I had more patients, give like a whole hour or 2 hours of me explaining what white supremacy is and like why their behavior was harmful towards me or towards someone else, or blah, blah, blah. And then having someone constantly say to you for like 2 hours, like, you're wrong. That's not real. Like, and so when people are at that stage of not even believing it's real, it's like, how can you do anything? That's what I think is quite difficult with this, is it's like, how do you go beyond that? Because there can be all this kind of performativeness of being like, oh yeah, we care about Black Lives Matter in medicine. But if in not only my experience, but also I've spoken to like other, especially Black women around the country who've had the same experiences that I have, or even worse ones, where they've literally had to leave their medical schools. I've talked to multiple people who've had to leave their medical schools because of racism, and because it was that bad. And yeah, I think that's what's hard, is that medicine is almost like an amplification of like the rest of the world in a lot of ways. And I think that's why these issues exist. But then this is my own theory, but I also think that because at medical school, and especially in the medical profession, you're told by everyone like, oh my gosh, you're so smart, you're the best of the best, you must care so much, you're so good at everything, that it means that if you're told your whole life, or almost all the time, that you're so great and so amazing, it's going to be really hard to see how you can also be perpetuating harm. I think that with a lot of these people, like, they just genuinely do not believe that they could be perpetuating harm. They do not believe that it's possible, because they are the best of the best and they've been told that for like their whole life. And that's why I think it's just such a deep and difficult issue that I don't really know how to solve it. I don't really know the best ways to do it. Like, I think obviously more Black doctors would help, but I think the institution itself is just also very racist. I'm the only Black student in my year in medicine.
Wow.
And yeah, and that's been a whole a whole thing, a whole terrible thing, in many, many ways. But I do think that, like, for me personally, having other Black students in my year would be great, or even having maybe Black teachers, like Black doctors, to teach us. But I don't think that would solve the issue. And that's why I think this kind of links to like representation and the idea that representation would solve things. I don't think it will solve things if there are systemic issues. I think it could help. But I think that this is when I talk about like disrupting or agitating or destroying, I think that medicine as an institution was built off white supremacy and racism, like in the way that so many of like gynecology as an institution was built upon performing procedures on enslaved Black women who did not consent to procedures and were not given anesthetic and had things happen to them. Like if things are built, I find it really difficult if things are built off oppression, if all of its kind of roots and everything have been built off oppression, then how do we use that same system to get liberation? I just don't think, I kind of feel like we need to overturn things as a whole. Also, I realized that I just talked for like 10 minutes straight about random medicine and stuff. But yeah, I think this is something I'm still working out in my head, but I also really want people to be more aware of how medical racism is a very present thing and that needs to be tackled. And I would be interested if anyone like is a black doctor doing this work. Like if you're listening to this, like please reach out because I'm interested in how we can do that because I'm also not really sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I love that. Don't apologize for talking to, it's not too long at all. I was really enraptured in what you were saying. I think that in a similar way, it kind of sounds like a bit like what I've, the understanding that I've come to have around policing now is kind of the same, where it's sort of like, well, the police systems were literally built off the concept of oppressing and marginalizing. So how can we still use that same means, mm-hmm. And not expect it to like recreate the same systems? And I think it makes complete sense to talk about medicine in that way. I think that one thing, I guess, that's happening that's getting quite a lot of media attention and might start to open the floodgates into people investigating this more is people talking about black women dying, being 5 times more likely to die in childbirth. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most, it's one of, probably one of the only things that I've seen actually broadly discussed about mm-hmm. the way that medicine is institutionally racist. And that's still only, again, come to the fore in like proper media, probably post our most recent civil rights protests that we've had. It's a long time coming, but
yeah, I mean, I did a global health policy degree last year and I wrote one of my essays on black maternal mortality rates. And in it, I kind of did a deep dive into like medical racism as a whole thing. And it was quite, I learned so much by doing that, but obviously I chose to do that myself. Like I made up the essay topic myself. Like I asked my professor if I could do that. This wasn't something that was being taught to the rest of my year. And I think that's what's difficult, is that even the knowledge that these things exist is something that we have to reach out and find out ourselves. It kind of links back to what you were saying before about, yeah, I guess what we wish we were taught at school. Like what I wish that everyone was taught at medical school was about medical racism and the fact that it exists. We had one lecture on race at my medical school and I felt like everyone was staring at me during it. I was like really in first year, really nervous. And the lecture was basically like, the lecturer's the lecturer wasn't black. And they were like, can people please let us know their experiences of racism? And I remember sitting there in first year, like one of my first weeks, being like, I'm already the only black person in my year. I don't know if I want to put my hand up and like, talk about this now, especially when you're like, I don't know, 19, 20. At least I just felt really nervous at that time. And that was our only education of race, was like that one lecture, which was quite pants, to be honest. And I've learned stuff about medical maternal mortality and loads of other things after, because of kind of researching that myself. And it seems like education around this stuff, it shouldn't be that we have to find it out ourselves, because especially anti-racism work is healthcare work, because through the case study of maternal mortality, we can see that, so people think that things are bad in the US more so than the UK, but actually in the US, black women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth, but in the UK, it's 5 times more likely. It's actually worse in the UK. And kind of reasons around that, there are so many different reasons. There's interpersonal racism, but there's also like stress of existing in like a white supremacist society is something that is seen as a contributing factor to lower kind of worst prognosis and worse outcomes for black patients. And so therefore dismantling white supremacy is healthcare, because it will improve people's health in so many different ways. And yet we're never really taught about it in that context. And it's always like, oh, well, we've got so much science to learn that we don't have time to, I've heard this from other doctors, but we've got so many other things to learn. There's just no time to learn about racism. Mm-hmm. But it's also like to say that is, and then these are the same people who will then spend like I don't know, hours and hours of their time reading articles about like fish lungs or something, like something that is just not, I don't know, not actually relevant to a lot of their work or that is not important. And it's just frustrating how much people will say these things when they are literally just saying like, I actually don't care. Like they'll make these excuses of, oh yeah, we've got so much other stuff to do. But what you're saying is this isn't a priority to me. I don't really care. And I really would love to see some significant change with that. But I mean, I'm not holding my breath now. I think I'm hoping that I can be the best doctor that I can for my patients, and especially for like for all of my patients. And I can do healthcare work that is like anti-racism work and stuff. But I think I'm, yeah, I guess I hope that there'll be change, but I think I've just been scorned so much from this institution that I don't know. It's just quite tricky.
And also, like kind of what you're saying about you having to seek out that information, it shouldn't really be on the, like your responsibility as a Black doctor to be doling out all of this information, and nor should it be on any other Black doctors or Black students. You know, this is where this education becomes crucial, because again, it's just more emotional labor for you. Like your lecturer asking you to talk about, I mean, I do that sometimes on these podcasts in the context of the guest is like talking about, but I wouldn't be like in a seminar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Being like,
yeah.
Talk to me about your trauma.
Yeah, it's like in my lectures, I'm the only person to, well, so I also can't say that I'm the only person in my whole year to have ever asked these questions, because I don't know if people are asking them privately. And I don't know if they're in a different lecture or whatever. But in my personal lectures or tutorials, we've been having lectures on skin and lectures on trauma and things like that. So things that present on skin, and that we're always taught to look out for redness, and we're shown pictures only of white skin ever. And I'm the only person who ever says, hey, what does it look like on a darker skin tone? Like, you only showing us this on white skin is just perpetuating medical racism, will mean we won't be able to spot things on darker skin patients. And a lot of the time, I really don't think these doctors are actively being like, I just want to be racist. Like, that's also not how racism or white supremacy works. Like, I think that it's in the omission, it's a manifestation of white supremacy, and that omission still harms people, whether it was intentional or not. And I think it is exhausting to have to always be the person to kind of raise that, because I just feel like other people should be, especially, I don't know, especially after this summer. I think that's something that's been kind of frustrating, is all these people I saw post these flipping black squares or share infographics, their stories. And then when it comes to actually doing something, it's just silence and crickets everywhere. And that's what has been, I think, most frustrating actually post the summer, has been like the lack of translation of this anti-racism work from being online or on your stories or on your social media to being in real life.
Yeah, I think this, so my sister's a dermatologist, and this is something she actually said to me, was like, she was like, the other thing is, she was like, there is no, like, even if you're looking for it, she's like, there is no case study. She's like, every case study I looked through in all of my textbooks, everyone is white. So it goes even further than like in that moment talking about it. It's like historically, there's not even, like even if you ask the question, they might not even have thought about the answer. Like what does happen if someone's got dark skin and it can't go red? Or there's so many things in the language that she's actually become more conscious of. She was doing a post about her dermatology, and she was like, oh my God, I've just realized if I say this, that's actually really not relevant to these people or this. And because you have that, especially as a white person, that natural bias to default white and don't, which isn't an excuse at all. It's just, it's really odd to think that it's gone on for that long. Oh my God, I don't want to talk too much actually, because I want to did you have a point to say to that bit, or can I go on to your next bit?
I was just gonna say quickly that I, with all of this, I think people just need to remove, I think if everyone could just remove the feeling of guilt and from it, because I think that what will happen sometimes when I'll say these things is that people will kind of take it as this personal attack towards them, I'm not racist, and it's like that shouldn't be the priority. I think guilt can sometimes be a very self-serving emotion of like, oh, it becomes all about you. And actually, like, people who are doing these things, or like, if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize how much I'd only learned about white patients or just thought about white as the default. Like, we all live in this white supremacist society. So the things that we do say, think, act on will be a manifestation of the society in some ways. And it's not about the individuals, it's about a system as a whole. And like, if we just kind of let ourselves be arrested in this state of guilt, we're not really going to get anything done. And so I think I just want people to like, it's not personal, and we need to stop just making it just about ourselves and kind of move into a bigger space.
Yeah. And also, as you said, like, guilt is so halting, but you become like dwelling on it. And actually, if you're really indignant, like, I've had to learn this, like, if you indignantly want to say, oh, I'm not racist, I didn't mean that, then you've got to accept whatever the situation is and change it. Okay. I was going to say onto a lighter topic, but it's not really. Your third thing is you wish you'd been taught about climate justice. And I think that it's another crucial one. So yes, let's leap into this.
I actually think that climate justice, for me, is something that's very hopeful and very wonderful. And that's why I wish I'd been taught about it. Because I think that the only way that I had been taught about the climate crisis was as this, either as this like kind of not that important thing, or as this big, awful, looming threat, which it is. But through the lens of climate justice, we can see how in the way we tackle the climate crisis, we can also tackle inequality, and like how wonderful that is, and like how many co-benefits there are. So like from a medical perspective, again, in the Lancet's report on climate and health, I think it was in 2005, they originally said that the climate crisis was the greatest threat to global health. But then in 2016 or 15, in their next report, they said that the climate crisis can be seen as the greatest global health opportunity. And the reason that it can be seen as a global health opportunity is because when we take this lens of climate justice, so climate justice is a principle that sees that the climate crisis is interconnected with other social justice struggles, other struggles for liberation, and other oppressive struggles, and that we cannot separate any climate work from anti-oppression work. So the climate crisis is inherently connected with gender oppression. It's inherently connected with racism. It's inherently connected to ableism and so many other things, not only in the ways that it impacts people differently, and that some people are impacted more than others, but also in the ways in which how the climate crisis was created was based off a lot of these systems of oppression. So it was kind of based off this model of colonialism, of extraction and going into a country somewhere and harming the land and the inhabitants of that country in order to extract things for the benefit of majority white people living in countries such as in Europe or in the United States of America. And basically through a climate justice lens, we see that solutions to the climate crisis can also kind of dismantle, destroy these other oppressive systems. And I see just that as really hopeful. And I think that's why I wish I'd been taught about climate justice, because for me, my route into activism was through a migrant rights and migrant justice route. That's what I was involved with before I got involved with climate justice or any environmental work. Because I really cared about migrant justice. And then it was realizing how connected migrant justice was to the climate crisis and to racial injustice, and all of these things I cared about could come together under climate justice, that I started doing, I think, my like most important work, because all of these things are interconnected. Like all of these things, we have to look at them through an intersectional lens. Like Audre Lorde says that we don't have single issue struggles because we don't live single issue lives. And climate justice is a principle which sees that, the climate crisis is not just a climate struggle, because we all like inhabit this world and it is all connected and all of these systems are connected. And I think that's why I find it really hopeful and wonderful and important.
I was just about to say that actually it's so nice, because all of your points, if you initially look at them on paper, like the three things, they seem quite disparate, but of course they are in tandem with each other constantly. And, you know, trying to solve one problem will hopefully alleviate some of the stress of the other, et cetera.
I think that's why, like, because I was thinking of putting one of my things that I wish I learned at school was like, there's so many things I could write. And then I realized that these three things I felt like kind of encapsulated everything, because I wish that I'd learned about the impact of fast fashion, for example. And I wish I'd learned about intersectionality. But all of these things kind of come under the bracket of climate justice, because a climate justice lens also tackles how the fashion industry harms women of color in previously colonized countries or in countries that would be seen as traditionally global south. It also like impacts the patriarchy in so many different ways. It also impacts all these different things. Like climate justice is connected to all of these different things, and if we take this lens, then we can we can take an intersectional lens and we can kind of alleviate a lot of these struggles. And I just think it's really exciting. And I've learned so much from people who have been doing this work for so long.
What was your, you said that your entry into activism then was through talking about migrants and that kind of crisis. But what was your actual first action that you took in your activism that you were like, this is true activism, as it were?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that I had been doing activism for a while, not realizing it was activism. But then I think the first time that I was like, this feels like activism, was probably going to Calais for the first time, and volunteering at, so people, if people don't know, Calais is in France, and it's on the border of the UK and France. And there are, at least when I went the first time, there are quite a few hundred people who are displaced from their homes, who are trying to get to the UK because there's currently no safe routes of travel to the UK for people seeking asylum. And anyone in the world is allowed to seek asylum. It's a human right to seek asylum. But there aren't safe routes of travel, so people have to take unsafe routes, and people live in camps and they experience police violence. And there are grassroots organizations that are kind of set up in Calais that provide food to these people, provide warm clothes and tents, because the police will come in, they will, in sub-zero temperatures, they'll take people's shoes from them and they will slash their tent so they have nowhere to sleep, and they will prevent them from kind of accessing food, which is preventing them from accessing their human rights. And I went to Calais for the first time, I think I must have been like 17, I don't actually remember. I was like in my teens, and I just went along because I think I'd seen it on the news and I wanted to help out in some way. And that was the first time that I met kind of real life activists, if that sounds weird, in the way that I'd been to protests and things before, but I felt like I just kind of rocked up and kind of stumbled along. I'd done kind of things I didn't see as organizing but was organizing. But being there, I met these people who were just kind of normal people who'd just seen a problem and cared about it and did something about it and were also involved in loads of other different movements. I think that was the first time that I kind of realized that if these people who are super normal, but could do, but had done so much stuff, that you didn't have to be in Martin Luther King or an Angela Davis to be an activist. You just needed to do something. And these people had kind of done that. And I think that I found that was a very pivotal point, I think, in my life.
I'd love to ask you actually how you define activism, because I think especially at the moment there's a lot of chatter and bubble going on around about, you know, can influencers and activists, yeah, is that concept mutually exclusive? Like, I think that sometimes activism is heralded as being like one specific thing. So like, I don't know, like you said earlier, a really specific example, for instance, changing the law or whatever, and some people think, yeah, it's not individual action, it has to be legislation. How do you frame it in your mind, and I feel like it sounds like you come to it with a very compassionate perspective where you think that, you know, everyone, if everyone does what they can do, you can kind of be active in your own way, as it were. Is that how you frame it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that So I also saw a lot of this stuff that was conversation that was going on around influencers and influence activism and everything, and at first, it really stressed me out because I was like, is everything that I'm doing problematic and terrible? Even though I've obviously thought about this stuff, this is something that me and a lot of my friends talk about a lot and we reflect on a lot. I've noticed that, because for me, a lot of my work has migrated to be online and on social media this in the last year. And I don't know, it's so silly that I didn't realize it's because we're in a global pandemic. Like, we literally can't organize in person. Like, it's very difficult to. And also, there are so many other features that have made other parts of organizing that I've been involved with more so in the past kind of inaccessible, or just dealing with a pandemic has been stressful. And I think I'd really beat myself up about the fact that a lot of my work had kind of migrated to being online. I was like, and then loads of people online obviously being like, this isn't activism. And I was like, is it not activism? And basically, I think reflecting on all of this, and speaking to a lot of my friends and having like a lot of deep conversations about this, I don't know how. I think it's difficult because I don't think I can say what is and what isn't activism. And I also don't think that like many people can say what is and what isn't activism either. I think that activism itself is just being active in the face of oppression and a struggle and doing something about it. I do think that important and moving activism requires giving up of privilege, and that will look different for so many different people. But I think the real activism just means causing disruption and doing something. And yeah, that I can't say that everyone that says that they're doing activism is activism. Or I definitely don't think you have to change a law or anything like that. I think that even that can be scrutinized as to like that, obviously through so many different lenses around like the state and blah, blah, blah. There's so many things that I think every type of activism is different. And I think that we all have different roles. I think that there is definitely an issue when it comes to influencer culture and this kind of glorification of an individual and the making out this one individual is the blueprint of activism, and activism only looks like this one individual. That is definitely an issue. But I do think that activism can happen online. But I just think it's really essential that all of us resist. So Angela Davis says that it's essential for us to resist the depiction of history as the work of exceptional individuals. I'm kind of paraphrasing here, if all of us as individuals are able to realize our own power in being part of a collective struggle. And I do think that there are definitely times in which I think social media can kind of get in the way of that because we focus too much on one person's done this and that's really amazing, when actually all of us can be a part of a struggle. And the person who's printing off posters for an organization, their work is no less important than someone who is doing activism online on a platform and has loads of followers. Like, I don't think that a hierarchy is useful, and that kind of goes both ways. I don't think a hierarchy in saying that activism on social media is unimportant is helpful, but I also don't think that a hierarchy of saying that the only way to do activism is off social media is helpful. I think that we kind of need to have space to realize that there are so many different factors that play in. And like, I've had a lot of people since I've been talking about, because I've talked about this a lot on my Instagram recently, and I've had a lot of people DM me who are disabled and have said, like, I'm really grateful that you've talked about how social media activism is real activism because other forms of organizing aren't really accessible for me. Or I've had people who live in very white areas and who are Black message me and say, like, that they find organizing in person in their direct community quite difficult, just because their different identities are more visible. So I just think that there's a lot more nuance to this conversation. I do think there's some really important criticisms to be made around, like, profiting off liberation movements and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that needs to be talked about. I think redistribution of wealth is something that needs to be talked about a lot more, especially for people who make money in any sort of way off liberation. Because if there's no redistribution of wealth, then are we just kind of, this is something that might take longer to explain, but like, are we just trying to become the white man in the way of like being like, oh, well, we just want to accrue the same kind of resources as the current oppressor has?
Yeah, that was kind of what I was trying to say earlier, but I couldn't figure out how to say it, where sometimes like it can become profitable. It kind of isn't what I was saying, but it kind of is. Mm-hmm. Where like you don't realize that it feels like you're doing the right thing, but actually without realizing you have become the thing that you were trying to dismantle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. And this is something that I check in on myself a lot because I think this is something that I'm still working out a lot, because I recognize that by kind of accident, I've become part of influencer culture. And that was like a complete accident. Like, this summer, my following grew significantly at the result of Black people being killed. And that was quite traumatic in itself. And then that's kind of catapulted me into this different space and having to navigate different things that I didn't really expect to have to navigate and make decisions about things. But I think that's why it's important for all of us, especially any of us who are doing this work, to check ourselves on these things. And I think there does need to be a much bigger conversation around redistribution of wealth and like kind of more transparency around that, especially for those people who do kind of social media activism-y stuff and then also kind of make money in some ways. I think it's a really difficult conversation that we could probably have like a whole hour discussion about. It's something that definitely I've been thinking about.
Totally, because I'm also in that I don't see myself as an activist, but I definitely have conversations which really center around social justice, and then I also make money from my platform, so I then also have been sitting back and thinking, how do those things marry each other, and should they, can they coexist, and if they can, what is the correct way of doing it, kind of thing. It's definitely and I think that'll be an ongoing conversation because social media is so new, and also because of the way society's changed. Like, just as you were talking, and I was thinking, oh my god, I don't even class myself
myself as an influencer activist, but I was like, oh my God, is that not real activism? But actually, we spend most people spend most of their times online. Like, we don't really, people don't exist outside pandemic or not as much as we used to. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a slight resistance because people are feeling nostalgic for the old way of rioting and the old way of, you know, mm-hmm. change. But actually, in a really sadly cynical way, it's likely that lots of this stuff will just be all online now. That's kind of the way we're moving. So maybe we need to be less resistant about the way things are being packaged and more focused on whether or not it's having, you know, a great impact. I think that there's so much kind of snobbery around things being done online when actually I think that's kind of unhelpful sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that one thing that's kind of made me maybe a little bit sad out of this is I'm like, I hope this doesn't just make people feel like they are less of an activist just because they do stuff online, because I just think that's not that. I just don't actually think that's very helpful. Like, I hope this doesn't push people away. Because one thing is, I feel like people are, I'm scared of people online just dragging me for anything I do. And I do think we've kind of built up this quite troubling culture of feeling like we are entitled to someone else who we don't even know, and to like drag all that they are as a human being. And I think it's difficult though. I think this is something that like I'm also still like working out, so it's quite hard to like have a line on it. But I think it's just something that we all need to like check in on ourselves on a lot, especially in this space. But I don't want it to mean that people don't talk about issues because they're too scared that they're going to be called an influencer activist or whatever. Like, I was like, am I an influencer activist? I don't know. I don't really think that these labels matter that much, but that's just me.
No, I agree. And I've even been there before where sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I'm just not going to talk about anything because I can't. I'm like, I don't want to deal with the dragging. Like, I don't think I can, like, mentally, I don't think that some of the pylons that I've watched online, I don't think I have the mental capacity. I wouldn't be able to cope. And I watch it and it's very scary. And I think that when you're someone who's a creator, you know what it feels like. Even if sometimes I'll just get loads of messages, people being like, oh, I'm disappointed in you. And that can make me feel like terrible, even though that's kind of like not, that's not really like a, someone trying to cancel me, they're just kind of expressing like disappointment. And if that's enough to kind of make me not want to talk to anyone, I can't even imagine. So I think I think that because it's getting so catastrophic, like this like huge kind of battling, I'm hoping that that's going to calm down a bit and people are going to start extending olive branches, because the huge bit of lacking that we're having right now is just people on total opposite ends of the spectrum not having any sense of communication because of echo chambers and polarization. And I think that's what's heightening everything. And I'm hoping that as we're seeing, like every time there's been a vote for something in this country that's gone wrong, like we need to kind of talk to each other more before we get angry, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But it's hard.
I think it's hard because social media like runs on the system of being fueled by outrage and are fueled by like hot takes and being and having like a really defined line about something and not kind of allowing space for nuance. And then I was talking to a friend recently who I know through organizing, and we organize together and do different community action groups together. And we were talking about how kind of the concept of accountability and community accountability from organizing spaces has been just taken completely out of context and applied to social media, which is a completely different space. And that real accountability isn't really happening online. It's just like this kind of faux accountability where actually people are just being dragged, and it's not actually the same as real accountability. And it's just kind of appropriating a lot of these terms that have been taken from liberation struggles that are really beautiful and important and like vulnerable and intimate things, and then applied to just drag people. And it's not the same thing. And I think that that's what's kind of frustrating. And it is kind of worrying because I don't think I could mentally deal with a pylon. I don't think I could do that. Like, I find it already tricky enough when like I get racist people in my DMs, or even just people just, telling me they're disappointed in me. I think that's why recently I've done quite a few posts just being like, please do not put me on a pedestal. If you're going to, then please just unfollow me and leave this space, because I'm not going to meet your expectations. I promise you. I'm sure I'm going to let you down in some way. I'm sure I'm going to get something wrong because I'm a human being, and I'm happy to admit when I've got things wrong and I'm happy to grow and learn, but I'm not going to be this superhuman perfect person. And you really need to stop expecting anyone to do that. And I'm also checking myself on that because I think I expect everyone to get nothing wrong sometimes. I'm like, whoa, that's actually just not how people are. Like, that's just not real. And like just expecting someone to be perfect and then dragging them when they're not isn't accountability.
No, and I think that this is maybe a learned thing because of being online and being on the receiving end of like constant opinions. But you learn, like, I now am so much more patient with someone if they get, because I'm like, if I criticize you for not knowing something, that is basically, I have to be saying then I am 100% certain that I'm 100% right on everything that I know. Obviously, if it's mm-hmm. someone with really abhorrent views, you can kind of like say something, but it's more like when someone gets something slightly wrong, I'm just like, well, they probably just didn't know, and that's fine, because there's so many things where I've been pulled up politely and I've been like, oh my god, I had no idea, and it's fine. And then in other instances, people really get outraged that I didn't know something, and it's like, if you feel that towards other people, you have to check yourself and think, in this are there situations in my life where there's loopholes in my knowledge or my understanding? Then it's just a bit more compassion, I think, and it's hard to find that online sometimes.
Yeah, and I think there's something that I always say to myself. I don't remember who said it, but I saw it somewhere. It's like, don't counsel people for things that you've only just unlearned yourself.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of like the way in which I, because also I definitely used to believe so many horrifically horrible things that I am really glad I did not have social media when I was younger, because I'm sure I would have written like tweets or something about things that were just stupid just because I was a child and I didn't understand things. And then it's weird how easy it can be for me to even forget like the times in which I had problematic viewpoints, and then it have these really strange expectations of everyone to just know everything now. Like, we didn't all like leap out of the womb as these like unproblematic, like intersectional, amazing activists. We all are going to get things wrong. And I think that part of this though is both, like, I think we need to be so open to being called out about on things and being told where we're wrong about things, especially where we're harming people. And I think we need to check our egos when we receive messages like that, or something. I need to check my ego, and I know when I receive messages like that, and not immediately dismiss it, but actually like check myself on like, am I doing this? Is this something I don't know about? How can I change my behavior? But also we need to like look at the people that we see and realize that they are also going to be a manifestation of this harmful world, and we can't expect them to get everything right all the time. And if you are seeing someone get everything right all the time, they're probably not showing you part of themselves. So I just don't think anyone's perfect or anyone gets everything right. And I think that there's so much more power in someone being honest about where they've got something wrong, and being honest about how they do consistently get things wrong, and they consistently believe things that like they should not have believed or that are harmful, but they are willing to change. That's so much more powerful than someone just being like, I'm perfect and I get everything right and I do everything right all the time. Like, I think there's just so much more power in being vulnerable.
Totally. And also, even if at that moment in time that person is as clued up, things are I change my mind on stuff all the time. Like, that influence activism conversation the other day really made me stop in my tracks, and I was like, right, do I need to reassess how I'm moving forward? Like, I'm consistently and every day going back on something which even I might have hashed out loads the first time, and then everything always needs revisiting, and history is always going to show up our blind spots when we look back. You know, in hindsight, God, the things that I've done and said and thought are awful. But the positive thing is that you're looking back and it's different now, if that makes sense. I just think being able to change and allowing other people to change and grow is one of the kindest things you can do, because otherwise, one of the things is we hold people to the same standards that they were 5 years ago, or we expect everyone to stay the same. And without change and without growth, we'll never get to that beautiful world you were talking about with yoga and not yoga, scuba diving and books. That sounds
great. Yeah, like that's one thing that, so Andrea Davis, who I do love a lot and think that she's really great, as much as I'm trying not to glorify individuals, I do think she is really, really great, but she talks a lot about not glorifying individuals as well. But one thing that she talks about in a recent Time magazine article was about how she's actually kind of almost glad that they didn't achieve the world that they were aiming for, because it was limited by their understanding of things. Like, she says that she just didn't, in the 60s when she was fighting for liberation, she didn't have an understanding of trans struggles in the trans community, and that the world that they were fighting for wouldn't have been the best world because it wouldn't have been aware of those issues. And she's someone who I respect loads. And I think that seeing her be honest about where she's been, like had a huge discrepancy in her understanding of liberation, is really helpful because it's like, okay, I'm sure that there'll be so many spaces in which I don't have a full understanding of the best way to do things, or I don't understand everything completely. And I think that's like quite wonderful that the world that I can imagine as the best world ever won't even be as good as it can get. There's actually so much more that I won't even understand. And I think that's just really like quite lovely. And I think that that's how I view things being wrong. I'm like, and one thing I was talking to the co-host of the Yikes podcast that I host, I was talking to Joe for a Patreon episode yesterday, and we were talking about like also congratulating yourself for the person that you could have become if you didn't unlearn these things, and like how you've in unlearning things and making other decisions to change your behavior, you are where you're at now, rather than feeling guilty for the things that you used to believe, or that how problematic that was. Instead, you can be like, I didn't choose to go down that road. I can acknowledge that I was in that space, but I could have become this other person. And yeah, I just think that change is really important, and growth and is really beautiful.
I love that. I think that's such a nice thing to end on. I don't want to keep you. I realize we've been talking for ages, although
I speak so much. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God. No, I would keep going for hours, but I really don't want to keep you because I feel bad. But honestly, you've been such an incredible guest. You really, you know, sometimes you speak to someone and it gives you that, like, I've been feeling a bit deflated. This happened to me when I spoke to Shona Virtue as well. It's probably the world, but I've lost that want to learn and do stuff and take action. But talking to you, mm-hmm. I think you're such a positive person. And even though what we've spoken about has been so heavy, your attitude towards it is so like invigorating. It's just been an amazing chat. So I'm very grateful to you. If people don't follow you, or you have anything that you want to share, I know you've got your amazing podcast. Is it called The Yikes Podcast?
It's called The Yikes Podcast, yeah. So that's like a good space to listen more about. We have episodes on so many different things. We have one on what is climate justice, if anyone's interested in that. And we have amazing guests and stuff on there as well. You can find me on Instagram. I'm just at Michaela Loach, or I mean, Twitter terrifies my soul, but I also have Twitter, which is also at Michaela Loach. And yeah, I mean, you can find me in all those spaces. We've got some other exciting things coming out this year. There's three different projects that if you check out my Instagram, it's probably the best place to kind of find those things when they do come out. Yeah, I've loved this conversation so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's been so enjoyable. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for listening. I will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.